Those Who Love the Truth, the fifth talk in a series entitled Those Who Belong to God, was presented by Ron Julian on September 15, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I have been talking for the past several weeks about some of the other ways that the Bible describes the people of God, besides describing them as people who believe in Jesus. Some of the things that we've talked about up to this point, I've talked about loving God, fearing God, hating the world, and being honest about our sin. The point of talking about these things, and what I've been trying to get across, is that it can be misleading, and has been misleading, I think, in the life of the Christian world, to talk about believers as believers, as those who believe in Jesus, because it doesn't take too much looking in the Bible to see that there are those even pictured in the Bible itself who believed in Jesus but were not in fact people of God. That is, they heard the story about Jesus being the Messiah and they believed it for reasons that they found personally compelling. But in the end, their lives showed a commitment to certain truths that were actually antithetical to the gospel that they believed. And that the belief in the gospel that is truly significant in someone's life is that belief in the gospel that is rooted in a certain change of disposition towards the world, towards themselves, towards everything, really. And so that's why the Bible at one and the same time can say that we're justified by faith in Jesus, and yet at the same time describe God's favor as coming to people who are characterized by other qualities as well. This is not a contradiction. They all sort of work together. And one of the things that I have tried to do in my own study of the Bible and in my own trying to come to terms with my own life as a believer is to try to sort out a little bit the tension between, on the one hand, an emphasis in the Bible that we are accepted by God, justified, are in His favor in spite of who we are and what we are as people, in spite of our failure, in spite of our sin, in spite of the evil that characterizes our life at times. And yet at the same time, there's an emphasis in the Bible that would say that we are accepted before God because of who we are. Not in the sense of earning anything before him, but just in the sense that there are certain things that are true of the people of God. And if they are not true of you, then you're not one of those people. There's a real tension there. On the one hand, an acceptance in spite of who I am, and yet a message that says, if you want to think of yourself as one of God's people, then there are certain qualifications that have to be true. The good news is that those qualifications are not things like the absence of sin, moral perfection, having it all together, knowing all the right answers. I mean, we could make a long list of what those qualifications are not. But the fact is that the work of God in someone's life leaves a mark. And that mark is more complicated than just saying, I believe. Saying, I believe is not the extent of that mark. And so what we've been trying to do really is look at some of the ways that the Bible characterizes the people of God? What are the aspects of that mark? Today, I want to talk about another one. I would say that the Bible tells us that the people of God are those who love the truth. These are not in any particular order. If they were in a sort of a logical, rational order, I probably should have started with this one, because in a way I think this is foundational to all the others. Now, let me try to say right off what I'm talking about and what I'm not talking about here. We can get the idea, if we're saying that truth is of central importance in our relationship with God, in determining the direction and outcome of our lives, the Christian world out there is all ready to jump in and say, oh, sure, well, I know what you mean. I mean, there are certain true-false questions that you have to get right, and if you get those questions right, then you're in, and if you don't, you're not. So yes, the truth. You have to know that Jesus is the Christ, and you have to know that he was raised from the dead. And so, of course, yes, knowing the truth, that's what characterizes the people of God. But I'm saying more than that. I agree that there are truths about Jesus that believers are called on to believe. But I am trying to say more than that. It seems to me that the picture that the Bible paints is that we as sinners are allergic to certain kinds of truth. The truth about God, the fact that I'm not God and He is, the fact that God is good, the fact that God created me and I did not create myself. Truths about myself, that I am a creature of God, that I am a sinner who needs mercy. The truth about my neighbor, that my neighbor is in fact as important and as significant as I am. The truth about the world around me, that the treasures of this world are not all that valuable and that if I go running after them, they will fail me. All of those truths are fundamental truths about life. They are describing reality the way it is. But they are truths that we do not find easy to deal with. We would really like the world to be different. We would like God to be, at best, no bigger than we are. We would like to see ourselves as at the center of the universe. I mean, it's just a nice place to live. It's a nice neighborhood. The people of God are those who, by the grace of God, are being freed from this allergy to the truth. And we're not just talking about having the right answers here. What we're talking about is having a disposition of heart towards reality that says, I accept the world the way it is. I see things the way they are, and I'm not fighting it. And so we're talking about a bottom line, fundamental commitment of the heart. Am I a person who in the end is willing to turn towards what is true and right, or am I turning away from it? If we were to just start at the beginning of the Bible and go through to the end, I think one of the ways we could characterize what we find there is we could describe the Bible as the story of a number of people coming to terms with the way things really are, or else not coming to terms with the way things really are. We start out in the Bible looking at the story of Adam and Eve in the garden, and we can describe that as an example of the disobedience of Adam and Eve to a command from God. And that's true enough. It was disobedience. But as we look at the story, we can see that fundamentally, the story is about two people coming to terms with the truth about God. They have a God that they have come to know something about. They see a fruit which is attractive. They're hearing lies from the serpent about what God's motives are in withholding it from them. And they're having to sort out what's true. Is that fruit as valuable to me as I think it is? Is God to be trusted or not? In the end, the failure of Adam and Eve comes down to a failure to embrace the truth about God, about that fruit, about themselves. When we tell the story of Abraham, and find that story in the Bible, it's a story of Abraham's obedience in going to the land that God had promised, in being willing to sacrifice his son when he was asked to do it. But the story of Abraham really is a story, in a lot of ways, about someone who has come to terms with the truth about God. He hears promises from God, and he recognizes that those promises are valuable, and he believes that God is going to do what he said he was going to do. The obedience that he offered in being willing to sacrifice Isaac, as we explore the story and look at everything that the Bible says about it, we can see it comes down to Abraham's understanding that God was to be trusted, that God would keep his promises. So Abraham, when he faced that decision, am I going to obey God or not, was really wrestling with the question of what is true? What should I do? What action should I take? What path should I go down? And the decision he made was based on what he ultimately decided was true about the character of God, about his own needs, and so on. When we come across the story of Abraham's children hundreds of years later, being taken out of Egypt to the Promised Land, in a lot of ways, that story is about a whole generation of Israelites coming to terms with the reality about God. Who is he? They have this strong disinclination to distrust their own instincts. That is, I have too many negatives in there. What I'm saying is they were inclined, as everyone is, to think that they understood how life worked and what they needed. So they get out in the middle of the desert. Never mind the fact that a couple of days ago God parted the Red Sea. Right now, there's no water, and that's a stupid thing to do, to go out in the middle of the wilderness with no water. Everybody knows that. But the fact is that reality was deeper and richer and more complicated than they were willing to acknowledge. God was there. God had promised to take care of him. God was the creator and is the creator of all that exists, and a lack of water in the desert is not a problem to him. So, in a sense, although the story of the Exodus has a lot of action and miracles and fights and battles, and I mean, it's an interesting story in terms of what happened, it seems to me that the dynamic of the story centers around the issues of truth that the Israelites face over and over again. Who is God? What is true? What am I going to count on? We look at the wisdom literature in the Bible, and we find something like Ecclesiastes, where Solomon is going out into the world and basically trying everything. And saying, I tried some of this, and I tried some of that. And in the end, I concluded that none of it really solves my problem as a human being. None of it really satisfies. And that's the great thing about the book of Ecclesiastes. Although it can seem rather dark in its conclusions, the fact is that as a piece of wisdom literature, it is in touch with reality. It is telling us the way things really are. And so, to be in touch with reality is held up as a great virtue in that book. To be able to see what will really satisfy and not kid yourself into thinking that you can find meaning and fulfillment ultimately in things that were not intended to ultimately fulfill. To understand the message of Ecclesiastes is to see the truth about reality. When Jesus comes on the scene and we find his teaching, a lot of what he had to say was confronting the people of his time and us as well with the issue of how are things really? Let's forget about what your religious tradition has taught you. Let's forget about what you would like to be true, and let's talk about how is it really? What is really going to solve your problem? What is life really all about? So he tells parables, like a parable about a guy. He has a lot of stuff, and he thinks, what I really need to do is build bigger barns, because frankly, my barns are stuffed now. How am I going to gather more stuff if I don't have some place to put it? So I'm going to build an even bigger barn so that I can have even more stuff in it. And as soon as it gets built, God says to him, you fool, this very night your life is required of you. And so now who's going to have all of this stuff that you gathered up? He wasn't in touch with reality. He had this idea somehow that if he could just gather up enough wealth in this life, that was the answer to his problem. But it wasn't. So over and over again, we find in Jesus stories about people who are shrewd. The guy who's going to lose his job, so he makes sure that he gets in good with some other guys so that he has some place to go after it's done. There's the five foolish and the five prudent maidens who, the prudent ones, recognize that the bridegroom may be a long time in coming, and so they make sure to take some oil with them. In all of these stories, we confront the issue of what is it that's true? What is it that's real out there? And that comes down to some very practical questions at times. What is going to pay off and what is not going to pay off? If you're seeking after that which is going to be good, that's going to enrich your life, that's going to bless you and make life what you want it to be, what are you going to run after? Where are you going to find it? And ultimately, when we're confronted with the gospel itself, the gospel of Jesus, the gospel gives us really a new picture of reality. It pulls all of that stuff that the Bible has been talking about together in the story of the salvation that Jesus is offering through his death on the cross and resurrection. And it asks me to embrace this new picture of who God is and who I am and what is really valuable. To personally believe and embrace the gospel, I have to come to terms with the most uncomfortable truths about life. The great insults in the Bible are to call someone a liar or a fool. That is, I'm either someone who is deliberately falsifying what I know to be true, or I'm just too dense to see what in fact is really there. Now, I don't want to say too much here, but it seems to me, as I've been thinking about this, that the truth is a big part of what makes virtue virtue. I'm not going to say that it exhausts what makes virtue virtue, but what I mean is, if we think about what are the two great commandments in the Bible? Love God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. There is a real element in both of those of coming to embrace a truth that is, by our nature, unpleasant and uncomfortable to us. Loving God with all my heart means seeing God for who He is. That I stop denying that God is big, that God is good, that God deserves my devotion because of who He is and who I am. Loving your neighbor as yourself means coming to recognize the truth, the reality that your neighbor is as significant and as important as you are. The fact, I mean, I don't think that we always recognize how out of touch with reality we all are. I mean, in the fact that you and I are self-centered, which we are, and the fact that it's so obvious to us that our personal needs and wants and desires are significant, and that it's difficult for us at times to get it through our head that other people's needs and wants and desires could be as significant as our own. The fact that we find it so easy to be concerned about our own wants and find it difficult at times to put those aside for the sake of someone else means that we are really out of touch with what is true. Because while I am truly significant as a creation of God, I am no more significant than any other of His creatures. The person who has come to love his neighbor as himself is one who is in touch with reality, who sees things the way they are. So love, I think, it is not a cold, heartless, intellectual thing, but it is a reasonable and rational thing. To love God and to love my neighbor means to be in touch with reality and to see things the way they really are. Okay, well, I wanted to say all of that because I think that will help us understand why we find in the New Testament the people of God described as those who have a certain attitude towards the truth, and that that goes hand in hand with having a certain attitude towards Jesus and the gospel. We can start in the book of John, which has been very fertile territory for the things that we have been talking about. A lot of these issues surface in the Gospel of John. In chapter 8, verses 42 through 47, this is right after a very famous statement about the truth where Jesus talks about us as slaves of sin and says that if you are disciples of mine, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. But I wanted to look a little farther ahead than that in verse 42. Jesus said to them, "If God were your Father, you would love me, for I proceeded forth and have come from God, for I have not even come on my own initiative, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I am saying? It is because you cannot hear my word. You are of your father, the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I speak truth, why do you not believe me? He who is of God hears the words of God. For this reason, you do not hear them, because you are not of God." A very striking passage, I think. Jesus is in talking to those Jews who were rejecting his authority, rejecting his teaching. Jesus seems to be saying here that the human heart bears the mark of its ownership. That ultimately you either belong to Satan or you belong to God. And that part of the mark of that that can be seen in a person's life is, if you love lies, you belong to Satan. If you love the truth, you belong to God. Again, Jesus is recognizing that it's important whether or not they accept him, whether they believe in him as the Messiah. He has come, he has presented himself to them, and they have rejected him. And it's important that whether or not they have said, yes, you are the Messiah, or no, you are not. But he is connecting that with the kinds of people they are, whether God is their father, whether God has his mark, has his hand on their life. Belief in Jesus is seen to be a symptom of something else that is going on in them. And so, I mean, in what has to be, if you understand the value that the Bible puts on truth, one of the most cutting and insulting things that anybody ever said to anyone, Jesus says here, because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. I can explain why it is that you're not believing what it is I have to say. It's because it's true. That's why you don't believe it. I mean, it's hard to imagine anything more insulting that you could say to anyone is that you are an enemy of what is true. What I'm saying is true, that's why you're not getting it. And on the other hand, he who is of God hears the words of God. So what's striking about a passage like this to me is that it is connecting the idea of believing in Jesus with a more fundamental state of the heart. It's like the story about that Jesus tells about the parable of the sower, where the sower goes and scatters the seed on different kinds of soil. And what sort of a response results depends on the state of the soil. Well, that's basically the kind of thing that Jesus is saying here. It's not surprising to me that you, when you hear what I have to say, you reject it because your father is the devil. In John 18, we see another similar kind of thing. I don't know if it's necessary for you to turn to this. We'll just look at it for a second. But this is in John 18:37. Jesus is standing before Pilate, and Pilate therefore said to him, "So you are a king." Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And of course, Pilate has a famous question in response to all of this. But what I wanted to point out is that statement. Jesus seeing himself as one who came to bear witness to the truth, and that everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. There are those who, by the work of God, have a disposition towards the truth, which is, however difficult and painful it may be, ultimately, I want to know it. I want to know the way it really is. I want to know the God who is there. I'm willing to know about myself and who I am. I'm willing to discover that I've been wrong about what's valuable and what I really need in life. Those who are of the truth hear his voice. Otherwise, what he has to say isn't interesting, the way it wasn't interesting to many of the people at the time. This is almost a sidelight, but this passage has always fascinated me. You can look in Luke 11, verse 34. "The lamp of your body is your eye." Luke 11, 34. "The lamp of your body is your eye. When your eye is clear, your whole body also is full of light. But when it is bad, your body also is full of darkness. Then watch out that the light in you may not be darkness. If therefore your whole body is full of light, with no dark part in it, it shall be wholly illumined, as when the lamp illumines you with its rays." So here's how I understand what Jesus is getting at here. The lamp of your body is your eye. I mean, he's just speaking of our very natural experience. When you open your eyes up, the light comes in. How do I see the stuff that the light is shining on out there? It comes in through my eye. So if my eye is good, that's the window through which all of the light comes in and I come to see it. If my eye is bad, then the light doesn't make its way in and I'm in the darkness. What's striking is this little turn that he makes. Watch out that the light in you may not be darkness. And I think what he's getting at here is that there's more to your eye than just the seeing that physical light that's out there. You could have the kind of eye that you can open it up and you can see everything that's out there. But in a spiritual sense, you're still in the dark. You're seeing it, but you're not getting it. You're not understanding what you're looking at. And so the great tragedy would be to have an eye that when it lets in the light, it doesn't let in the light. I can see, but I'm not enlightened. And the great blessing would be to be the sort of person that is wholly illumined, like when the light is turned on. When my eyes are open, I'm seeing what's really there. I see Jesus for who he is. I see myself for who I am. I see what's valuable in the world, the kingdom of righteousness that God has promised. I'm coming to see that that's where life is to be found. So, Jesus is picturing here, there's this great state to be in, this blessed state to be in, and there's this terrible state to be in. And the terrible state to be in is to be the sort of person who, when you look, you don't see. You can't see what's true. In terms of the value of the things you're looking at, in terms of the meaning of the things you're looking at. But the great thing would be to have an eye that when it's open, you are illumined. You can grow in understanding because you can see something of what's there. You can understand the value of something of the value of what you're looking at. And really briefly, let me just give you a couple of other examples here, and then I'll wrap it up. Paul has a couple of things to say that I think shed light on this stuff. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, actually, no, I think I won't go to that one. Let's just go to the 2 Thessalonians passage, chapter 2. Just a little Bible flipping practice here. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. This is a famous section for those who are interested in the question of the second coming of Christ and how's it all going to go down in the end. And part of what Paul is describing in 2 Thessalonians is this, is the man of lawlessness, and we won't go into all of that stuff. But he's describing this one, and starting in verse 9, he says, that is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. And for this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they might believe what is false, in order that all may be judged who did not believe the truth, but took pleasure in wickedness. Ultimately, there are those who receive the love of the truth, and he's connecting salvation. It is those who receive this love of the truth that will be saved in the end. And then there are those who ultimately are attracted to something that, even though it's a lie, is very attractive, and they follow it to their destruction. And without... What I'm suggesting in each of these passages is that they're talking about that fundamental thing about a person. Is this a person who belongs to God or not? Is this a person who is saved or not? Is this person going to find destruction ultimately or blessing? And in each of these passages, the connection is being made with the truth and a love of the truth. It is those who ultimately are not offended by the truth but are drawn to it that are going to be saved. There's one last passage that I want to read to you that has a lot in it, and I would like to come back to this passage in a later time and talk about it. But for now, I just want to read it, and because it is germane to the topic we're talking about here now. In Ephesians chapter 4, starting in verse 17. So Ephesians 4:17. Let me just read this to you and say something briefly about it. Paul says, "This I say, therefore, and affirm together with the Lord, that you walk no longer, just as the Gentiles also walk, in the futility of their mind, being darkened in their understanding, excluded from the life of God, because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the hardness of their heart. And they, having become callous, have given themselves over to sensuality, for the practice of every kind of impurity with greediness. But you did not learn Christ in this way, if indeed you have heard him and have been taught in him, just as truth is in Jesus, that in reference to your former manner of life, you lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lusts of deceit, and that you be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and put on the new self, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth." And so, what's striking to me in this passage is the way that the issues of purity and righteousness have been wrapped up in this topic. He's seeing the Gentiles as being hardened, ignorant, indifferent to what is true. And on the other hand, truth is in Jesus. And there is a renewal of the, that the Spirit of God is bringing about, which is a renewal having to do with the truth, he says. But what's striking is that the truths involved here have to do with the issues of what is good and what is right. That the Gentiles are pursuing their lusts. And in doing that, Paul seems to be saying they're pursuing an illusion. They're pursuing a lie. Their hearts are hardened to what is true. The things that they are pursuing in their lusts are not really good. They will not really satisfy. They are not what God has called us to. They are in many, many ways a lie. And yet they like the lie. It's a nice lie. It's a fun lie to believe. There are immediate benefits, immediate short-term benefits to believing such a lie. But those who have embraced the gospel have embraced a truth, and find God working in them in such a way that that truth is leading them to righteousness and holiness. That they're actually seeing the truth of what is valuable in such a way that they're recognizing the lie in the lusts of deceit. He calls them the lusts of deceit. These lusts that the Gentiles are pursuing are deceitful. They are telling you a lie. In following God, we are pursuing the truth and starting to see through the lie that the nations around us have embraced so eagerly. I think that's a helpful thing for us to remember, because unless you are very much different than me, the struggle with the lusts of deceit in this world are not altogether and entirely 100% over. I would not like to put a percentage on it at this point. Let's just say I find it very helpful to remember that the lusts for all sorts of things in this world ultimately are a lie, and that the promises that we find in the gospel are true, in whatever sense you want to talk about it. True in terms of what is right, true in terms of what is valuable. The world around me says it would be right to do that, but it's a lie. The world around me says you will really benefit if you run after that, but it's a lie. To be the people of God means that by the grace of God we are coming to understand that it is a lie and we would rather pursue the truth. It is not having all the right answers, and that's what I want to leave you with here, is just a warning of what I am not saying here. All of us are aware. I mean, we know how there is a kind of a pride and an arrogance that can result. And it can happen in Christian circles as well. The pride of feeling like you've got the right theological answers. I mean, sure, I love the truth. I mean, I could recite to you all of the points of doctrine that I've got right that all those other people don't have right. So I love the truth and they don't. It's not that simple. And the fact is that that attitude of pride and, you know, I've got all the theological answers is in fact not a good sign at all. And if we're talking about those signs of the mark of God in our life, that sort of self-satisfaction that you know, I know, just lay your theological question on me and I can tell you the right answer. There's something about that state of mind that's very dangerous, I think. And part of it is a sort of an unloving intolerance towards people who are still in the process of wrestling with these questions. In saying that the believer is, the child of God is the one who loves the truth, we are not saying that the child of God is the one who has come to understand all the truth and has no errors anymore in the way they think or the way they live. That's not true. I don't think the Bible is telling us so. That's part of the reason why the apostles have to keep writing letters to the people that they've preached the gospel to, reminding them what is true, calling them to pursue what is true, to remember the implications of what they have believed, and to turn away from bad implications of things that they thought would be okay and right, but in fact are totally out of keeping with the gospel that they believe. The issue is not how many answers have we got right today. The issue is whether our hearts are soft towards the truth, whether in time and over time we are embracing the things that are true about ourselves and about the world and so on. So to have that, I am not trying to promote here in holding up the truth as being so central in our lives. I am not trying to promote a kind of inquisition mentality where I check everybody out to make sure that they've got the truth the way I've got it. The issue is one of my personal stance towards the truth. It's not so much how much do I know, but in those places where life is pushing at me and I would really like to justify myself in my own mind, but the reality is there is no justification and I would do well to admit it. Is that truth something ultimately that I'm going to bow to or not? When it's becoming clearer and clearer to me that my plans for what makes a great life are not God's plans for what makes a great life, do I bow to that truth, or do I ultimately fight it and say, no, I'm not going there? it's that fight in the middle of my life that is ultimately the place where whether I'm a person who loves the truth is going to be worked out. And if we're aware of how much of a fight it is, I think it ought to keep us from getting cocky about, you know, how much truth we've got as compared to everyone else. Okay, well, let me stop and take any questions or comments or arguments or... Larry?
In the John passage, Jesus refers to Satan as a murderer.
Yes.
What does he mean by that, and can that relate to...
Yes. Well, I think that whole passage is revolving around, as several of the passages in John do, revolving around the issue of the response to Jesus by the Jews. And I think that language is arising from the fact that it's Jesus' recognition that ultimately their rejection of him is going to be so complete that they're going to kill him. And so, in saying that they are like his father, they embrace lies. The particular lies he has in mind are the lies about him, that he's speaking the truth about God and about what's important, and they're not buying it. That Satan, as a murderer, is one who is so opposed to the truth that he will even seek the death of those who are in fact committed to the truth. So I think him being a murderer and him being their father, he's sort of implying to them, you know, what in fact is going to happen is instead of you seeing the truth of what I'm saying, you're going to kill me. I think that's
a complete rejection of the truth.
Right, right. And that's one of the things that the cross signifies. I mean, the cross accomplishes a lot, but it has a lot of different things, as you think about it from different angles, that it means. But one of the things that the cross means is that the people of this world, when looking at the character and person of God in the person of Jesus of Nazareth, rejects it so completely that they kill him. And that's why Jesus can use the language about following him and picking up your cross, because he's basically saying, if you're going to follow me, ultimately the world around you is not going to be any happier with you than it was with me. So, yeah, that's a good way to put it. The rejection of the truth is so complete that it ultimately leads to death, to putting him to death. Christine?
That passage in 2 Thessalonians, you said, was tricky, and I need to go into it. A lot more of that. But I would like, I would really like that.
Which one now?
2 Thessalonians.
Okay, what was it talking about? Are you talking about the one with the man of lawlessness and all of that stuff?
You talked about the seed and food.
You might be thinking of the Ephesians passage.
Where the Gentiles were walking in darkness and we have been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth and that stuff. Lay aside the old self and... Yeah.
Right. Yes, I
think I am going to talk about that passage sometime. There are certain passages in Paul where he uses this language about the old self and the new self and all of that, which I have been sort of looking at and trying to come to terms with, and I would like to teach on that. I'm not quite ready to do that at this point, I don't think, but I would like to talk about that one.
It seems like a really difficult area to teach in teaching. It's like, you can't teach about America, you have to teach about this
and flowers. I'm not sure I know what you mean by that.
Lots of times we talk about truth, and we talk about things that are God is love, so we need to know that.
Right.
There's just kind of a list of truths to share.
Right.
And as you were speaking, I was thinking how difficult it was to hear and think about this, because you didn't do it in a simplistic way like that. You really tried to get underneath how this works.
Yeah, okay.
You did a really good job.
Oh, thanks. So that's what I was fishing. I did mention to you that all questions have to end with a compliment from me. No, I agree. I would like to teach on that passage in Ephesians. And even more, I would like to understand that passage in Ephesians. So I thought that a good order would be first I'll understand it, and then I'll teach on it. So. I appreciate it. Anything else? Yeah.
I found it interesting in the John 8 passage that Jesus was not particularly nice in holding a mirror up to them.
That's true.
He didn't spare their feelings. He didn't back away from lovely saying what reality is. And I find I have a tendency to want to soften things to keep from hurting people or keep them from opposing him.
Well, I think you're right. We can see in the life of Jesus that being nice is not necessarily a virtue. As Margaret wrote a paper once on that, you know, basically that sometimes love is not nice. That the if we're dealing with the truth, and if love for another person involves the truth, which it has to do. I cannot be loving and lie at the same time, I don't think. I mean, well, actually, let me step aside from that. There's a sense in which I could, and I don't want to use that. But what I mean is that ultimately I have to be pursuing the truth in my relationship with other people. And if they're living a lie, I'm not going to be doing them any favors by fostering that lie. So Jesus speaking bluntly to the reality of what was happening in their lives, that is something that we need to take seriously, I think. We cannot criticize an action that we ourselves might take or an action that somebody else might take on merely on the basis that it wasn't nice. Because if it was in fact edifying and loving and humble, then the fact that it wasn't nice is not relevant. And I think that you're right. That's a lesson to be drawn from this. I always come up against... I mean, I think I am not as... No, I don't. It's not that I think. I know that I am not as courageous as I need to be at times in the way I deal with people. But I do think that it's worthwhile to stop and remember that Jesus did have an advantage in this situation and that he really knew what was going on. I mean, he had great confidence, and rightly so, that he knew the heart of the people that he was talking to and what the problem was. Occasionally, I find myself in that, well, probably more often than not, in that spot where I think I see what's going on, but the fact that I'm sort of, you know, struggling myself to make sure that I'm seeing what's happening here, it always kind of, I feel like I need to walk slowly in this process, because just out of recognition of the fact that I am not God and I don't necessarily know all of what's going on. But you're right. I think that this ought to be a model for us to the extent that we feel that we really have seen something important in someone else's life, and we feel that there is a benefit to be gained by speaking bluntly to it, we shouldn't hold back out of the sense that somehow that wouldn't be a nice thing to do, because otherwise Jesus, he has lost his, I mean, he can't be our role model of what a righteous person looks like, because he was blunt. He seems to have been blunt all the time. It's just what's striking about him, and I'm trying to think of an example where he soft-pedaled anything, and I can't think of it. Lori? What I meant was, you know, we just the other night, so the reason I paused is the other night we were having one of those classic conversations about biblical ethics, about, you know, is lying ever justified and that kind of thing. And so, was Rahab lied about the spies being in her house. I didn't want my statement to be construed as such that there's no way that Rahab could have been doing what was right or true or loving in her life. She was doing what was loving. She was protecting the people of God from the murderous intentions of the folks in Jericho. And there was a lie involved. But I would say that in that lie, she was in fact pursuing the truth. I mean, she knew who God was and who these people were and the evil of what the folks in Jericho were going to do. So that's why I stepped back, is I just didn't want to say, I am in fact convinced that there are times when the evil intentions of others can be addressed with a lie. You know, the Nazis come to the door and do you have any Jews in your house question, you know, which we all wrestle with. I'm convinced that the right thing to do in that spot would be say, Jews? No, I don't have any Jews. So, now maybe I'm wrong in that, but that's the reason I stopped, is we need to be about the truth, but that doesn't mean submitting to the evil intentions of evil people by doing what they're asking us to do when they want to do something evil. That is not pursuing the truth, even if it involves me deceiving them about the people that they are trying to hurt. That's not what I would say there, is that I am in the pursuit of what is true, committed to the truth. But in the process of pursuing that, I told a lie. That's different. That's why I stopped and said, I could imagine doing something loving that involved a lie. I mean, you can disagree with me about that. That's all right. That's a big topic. But that's why I stopped. What I mean is that as people of God, we need to see what the truth is and not hide from it and be committed to it and not turn away from it when it is uncomfortable. That's the thing I'm trying to say. Okay, well, let's stop.